Case number 21-4235, Ohio et al. Versus Javier Becerra et al. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Flowers, you may proceed for the appellants.
Judge Moore, may it please the court, I'm Ben Flowers on behalf of the states, and I'll reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Fine.
This is a strange case in that the appellee during the appeal disproved its primary basis for arguing affirmance. In particular, HHS's Title X grants confirmed that the final rule irreparably harms the states by reducing the available funding. So before turning to the merits, what I'd like to do is discuss three ways that the court can address irreparable harm and resolve this appeal if it does agree with us on the merits. And the three options are final judgment, reversal, and vacature.
You say if we agree with you on the merits, but what if we feel that the merits are exactly the opposite of your argument? Can we resolve the case on the merits entirely? As you're arguing that we should resolve the case on the merits entirely in your favor?
Yes, that principle goes both ways. The court could resolve the case on the merits. So if the court agrees with us on the merits, it can enter final judgment, which would remove the need to address irreparable harm since that is not an element of an APA claim. The second option would be simple reversal of the order denying a preliminary injunction. The court could hold that we proved irreparable harm either at the time or in light of the new evidence, and simply reverse. Finally, the court could vacate the judgment below and remand on the merits, and then remand for the court to address irreparable harm in light of the new circumstance. That would at least clarify the governing law, which would spare the courts from having to adjudicate the merits before a court that's already decided them incorrectly, but it would allow the court to address it in the first instance. What we ask the court not to do under any circumstance is what HHS suggests, which is affirm based on the supposed failure of proof of irreparable harm at the time we moved. A, we think we did prove irreparable harm even then, but B, we suggest it doesn't make sense to affirm based on facts that we now know to be false. And frankly, that HHS declared to be false 1 week after they filed their brief, telling you that the irreparable harm here was entirely speculative. So if there are no questions on that, I can turn to the merits.
Well, are you going to talk about irreparable harm at some point or not? Is this the?
I'm happy to take questions on that. I think the grants confirm the point because they show that Ohio lost $1.7 million.
Isn't that a question of correlation as opposed to causation?
Respectfully, I think this goes to the census cases principle that judges don't have to be naive as to reality. We were getting less money when Planned Parenthood was in the program. They left the program. We got millions of dollars more. And now we're still the only two grantees and receive $1.7 million less. If the court is uncertain about that, though, then the...
But normally, if you say, for instance, if you have a certain level of health,
sure,
and if you take a pill and you get sicker, you can't say that the pill caused you to get sicker because it could have been that you were exposed to a colleague who had COVID or something like that.
And so if HHS wants to suggest that there is some other basis, they're free to do so. I highly doubt they can honestly tell the court that. But if the court is uncertain about that, that's where the third option comes in, where the court can clarify the merits, hold that the court erred, and vacate and allow the district court to address irreparable harm in the first instance. The other problem, of course, with the referral requirement is that the states, as grantees, are and have been forced to make referrals for a procedure that many of our state laws prohibit, or at least in circumstances where...
So what state law other than Nevada prohibits that?
Well, I'm not talking about referrals. I'm talking about referrals for a procedure that their state laws prohibit. So they're being forced to put their imprimatur on a procedure that state law disfavors.
So on that point, could the state have a statement at its facilities that are receiving Title X funds that would say, we do not endorse any referrals. We are simply required to make the referral under the Supremacy Clause because the federal government requires that.
We could do that, but in our view, we still would be, I think, undeniably putting our imprimatur on it. People could correctly say the state is encouraging abortion by telling people exactly how to go about getting one. But
they would simply be giving a referral pursuant to the requirement of the federal regulation, and they would be disclaiming it in my hypothetical.
Right.
Why wouldn't the disclaimer be sufficient to show that you were not putting the imprimatur of the state on it?
Because that puts us to a choice, and the choice is either withdraw from the program, don't take the benefits anymore, or else stay in the program, but help people obtain an abortion that you object to. And I think many of our citizens would regard that as a sort of imprimatur. I can turn to the merits. It'll start with program integrity because, frankly, I think it's the easiest way to resolve this case. The program integrity requirements violate Section 1008 in two ways. The first is express, where Section 1008 says that Title 10 funds cannot go to any program that receives where abortion is a method of family planning. The final rule expressly says, through the incorporation of the 2000 rules, that a program, is the term their rule uses, with both abortion elements and Title 10 elements, can get funding as long as they're not too integrated. And beyond the express violation, you can just look to what the final rule requires. Under the final rule, a grantee can operate a Title 10 program and provide abortions in the same facility, in the same rooms, with the same staff, using the same equipment, and they can even make referrals to themselves to perform an abortion perhaps 2 minutes later with the same doctors in the same room using the same equipment. Any family planning program that is so thoroughly integrated with the provision of abortion is a program where abortion is a method of family planning. To deny that would turn Section 1008 into a labeling game.
Is this program provision the same as the one that was in force for a long period of time, say from 2000 until 2019?
The regulations in question?
Yes. Okay. So was there any challenge brought during those approximately 20 years?
Not to my knowledge. But the fact that the violation was ongoing for a long time doesn't mean it wasn't a violation. I mean, the Supreme Court recently held that about a quarter of Oklahoma, in fact, wasn't Oklahoma for 150 years, even though we've run aware of that fact. So I don't think that proves much. There's certainly no case barring the court from holding this, and that includes Rust, because Rust said there's ambiguity, which means they can enforce the statute in any way that's reasonable. But what I just explained is an express violation, so that's not reasonable. And even beyond the express violation, it's hard to see what they think would violate Title 10, other than just someone being dumb enough to say we're using the Title 10 funds to pay for abortion. I don't know what their limiting principle is. I haven't heard one yet. It's certainly not in the briefs.
Can I ask a question? Do you think that Title 10 or Section 1008 requires some kind of physical separation? Is that your argument, or is it just that it has to be separate in some other way, but they haven't made it separate at all? What is the argument?
It's really the latter. I think because of Rust, I can't give you a bright line rule as much as I would love to do so. We think the best reading of the statute is physical and financial, strict financial and physical separation. But there at least has to be some separation. They say mere bookkeeping isn't enough. They concede that. But as I read the 2000 rules, it's not clear what short of a bookkeeping error could possibly lead to a violation.
So as you read Rust, Rust says, you can satisfy the separation is required. You can satisfy separation through physical requirements or maybe something else, but we don't know what that other something else is.
Right. I think it's going to be very hard to draw a bright line because of the ambiguity finding. But the fact that it's ambiguous doesn't mean there are no lines at all.
Yeah, and you're not saying that physical separation is required by the statute.
Not strictly required, but there has to be some way of making sure that the program getting the money is not one where abortion's a method of family planning. On the referral requirement, which I can briefly address, there are really two reasons we know that the referral requirement violates Section 1008. The first is Rust itself. Rust said that the statute can be read to prohibit giving referrals. It's hard to see how a statute that could be read to prohibit giving referrals could be read to require the giving of referrals, which is what the current rule does. But even if we go beyond that, just as a matter of order.
But wait, they don't say the statute requires the giving of referrals. They say the statute permits the giving of referrals.
Correct. They say the statute could be read to permit that. But it would be strange for the same statute that could be read to permit banning referrals to also be capable of being read to require referrals as opposed to simply allowing them.
Why couldn't the statute simply be silent on referrals?
Well, so I can get to this point, too, the ordinary English usage point. I mean, they concede at page 33 of their brief, and Russ says in footnote 4 that promoting or encouraging abortion is a violation of the statute. That makes your program one where abortion is a method of family planning. So I think given that, a program that's required to give abortion to every woman who wants one, tell her where and how to get an abortion, is necessarily...
You said required to provide an abortion. All the regulation, as I understand it, requires is that if the patient asks for a referral, that then the provider must give a referral.
If I said required to provide abortion, I'm sorry, I misspoke. They're required to provide a referral for abortion upon request. And what we submit is that any entity that is required to tell any woman who wants an abortion exactly where and how she can go to get one is encouraging or promoting abortion, which HHS concedes at page 33 of their brief would violate section 1008.
But if that same provider voluntarily chose to refer for abortion, you think that wouldn't violate Title 10, even though they were getting Title 10 funds? That's the piece, like you, sure. It seems to be that it's the mandatory nature that makes it a sticking point for you, and I'm just having trouble understanding that point. Why is it okay if you choose to do it, but...
So I think what it is having the policy that requires that it be done, because that's deciding in advance, our program is going to tell everyone who wants one how they can go about getting one. When you're pre-committing yourself to that sort of decision, you are necessarily, you have decided in advance, this is a method of treating this condition, and we'll tell people how to do it. One could argue, I don't think this is a good reading of the statute, but one could argue that if the program just takes no position on the matter, some doctors give a referral, some don't, that that's one that rather than being a program where it's a method of family planning, is instead a program that is ambivalent on the issue.
But what if the Title 10 grantee, when they applied for the grant, or at any time they've got their grant, and they said, well, our policy is that our voluntary policy, the government is not making us do it, is that we're going to refer for abortion upon request, you would say they'd have to give back their Title 10 funds?
I think if they have a policy where they doctors are required to do it, then yes, they would.
Okay, so it's mandatory.
Whether it's required by HHS or not.
Or not.
And I should stress that if the court disagrees with us on the referral but agrees with us on program integrity, then we agree with HHS that it would be appropriate to issue the final judgment on, you could do both, but say which one we prevail on and which one we don't prevail on. But I think at the very least, frankly, the program integrity requirements are the easiest to hold that violate Section 1008.
I have another question.
Sure.
On an admin law point, what happens, let's say we were to agree with you on both points,
sure,
program integrity and the referral, does the 2019 rule then spring back into effect to fill that gap, or what? How does that work?
In all of the plaintiff states, it would. So what would happen is this rule would no longer be enforceable, it'd be set aside. The 2019 rule was enjoined in Maryland. I don't believe that injunction was ever lifted or vacated, so it would stay enjoined in Maryland, but it would not be in the rest of the country. We make arbitrary and capricious arguments as well. I'm happy to rest on the briefing on that, but if the court has questions, I can also answer any you might have.
Your red light is on. So
all right. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Courtney Dixon for the secretary. Start just by clarifying the scope of what's before the court in this appeal. This court's review of the district court's denial of the preliminary injunction is limited to the record that was before the district court at the time of his denial. That record contained a single declaration of a single state, Ohio, that's at page ID 180. That record merely documents Ohio's status as a Title 10 grantee and speculates that Ohio will face more competition as a result of other grantees being back in the program. The district court and the motions panel of this court correctly held that, based on that record, Ohio had not established irreparable harm. I think that's sufficient to resolve this appeal, and if this case goes back to district court and Ohio has further evidence of its harms in light of participating now under the 2021 rule for nearly an entire year, it can introduce that evidence.
You agree they received less, right?
They received approximately $1.7 million less in grant funds, Your Honor.
And you agree that $2 million went to Planned Parenthood?
Yes, Your Honor, approximately, I think.
All right, just making sure. So can I turn to, I have a couple questions. From my understanding from the briefs is from 1975 to 2021, you've never found that a Title 10 grantee violated Section 1008. Is that correct? Or, yeah, 1008.
HHS explained in the final rule, Your Honor, that in determining whether to abandon the 2019 rules, onerous physical separation and restrictions on referral, it had conducted a fresh review of the record. It had looked at 30 reports from the Government Accountability Office, the Inspector General, and the Congressional Research Service, And those reports had uncovered no instance in which Title X funds had been used to pay for an abortion.
So can I go?
Wait, to pay? Oh, yeah.
Can I just go back and get an answer? So you've never found a Title X grantee to have violated the rule?
Well, Your Honor, you're referring to violating the rule. Generally, I can't speak to whether there have been other violations or compliance issues, but HHS found no instance in which Title X funds had been used to pay for an abortion.
How often do you, because HHS claims to engage in a robust monitoring process. How often do investigations occur?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, but HHS certainly explained in the rule that it does compliance monitoring visits. There are third-party audits, and there's auditing through grant reports. And grantees are also subject to ordinary regulations that apply to all grantees. And this rule has been in place for much of the history of the program.
Have you, to your knowledge, has Title X program ever had a problem handing out contraception?
I can't speak to the contraception question, Your Honor. I don't think that's within the scope of this court's appeal, which is involving, again, the relation between Title X and abortion. And again,
so you don't, but you don't know?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Have any states stopped a Title X facility from handing out contraception?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. But again, with respect to the question that's before the court here in the 2021 rule and its relation to abortion, again, HHS conducted a thorough review of the record, and it found that the 2019 rule's strict separation requirements were a very costly, burdensome solution for a problem that didn't exist.
Well, I'm having a problem because Section 1008 says you can't use Title X funds in a program where abortion is a method of family planning. So it seems to me that you need some robust idea of what a program or a project is. And you just say, well, it's a set of activities. So the prohibited activity is providing an abortion. I think that's the only one that's prohibited, or directive counseling on abortion. So how do I know when a grantee is in the program or somebody, and when they're outside of the program?
Well, Your Honor, the Title X program, you know, is the set of activities that the grantee has applied for and received Title X grant funds. That's a broad range.
Right, so I apply, say, I want to provide contraception, I want to provide abstinence-only counseling, natural family planning. That's what I'm going to use my Title X funds for. But I also provide abortions in my facility. And directive counseling. So how do I know, or somebody else know, how would you know as the enforcer, when somebody in the clinic is inside the program and when they're outside the program? Are they outside whenever they provide the abortion or provide directive counseling, and they're inside the program whenever they're providing contraception? Because that means it's a rule you can never fail. You will always be in compliance.
No, Your Honor, and to clarify some things that plaintiffs were saying, it would not be consistent with Section 1008 and HHS's rules to provide, for example, you know, Title X services and abortion-related services simultaneously. HHS explained in its final rule that it's more than mere technical bookkeeping, and that can be...
What is that? I'm sorry.
Yes.
Go ahead.
What is that? So all the examples are you must be able to account for cost. That's bookkeeping. Accounting for cost is bookkeeping. So what more do you think is required for separation?
Sure. The HHS-NIS rule refers to also demonstrating separation, for example, through counseling and administrative protocols. And if I could, Your Honor, I think...
What does that mean? What would those counseling and administrative protocols have to show? I'm trying to figure out what you say. The programs have to be separate. What is your understanding of separate? Because the only definition you seem to have given of separate is that they can be together as long as you can separate out the costs.
Again, HHS is referring to these protocols because it is a relatively fact-specific inquiry. There are thousands of different types of healthcare entities that participate in Title X, either as a grantee, a subgrantee, or a subcontractor. Those are in a variety of, again, different buildings, different types of staff arrangements, different types of service arrangements. And it might be that what might work for one grantee is different for another. For example, if you're in a large hospital, you could provide Title X services in one wing of the hospital and then abortion-related services in a separate wing. So, Your Honor, there's also examples of grantees, for example, providing abortion-related services on one day of the week and then Title X and other services on other days of the week. Again, there's not... just a very clear, bright-line rule.
But they have to do something like that.
Again, the rule does refer to...
But that sounds like physical or time, or at least time-based separation.
The rule,
but you say they don't have to do that.
No, Your Honor, the rule, again, refers to more than mere technical bookkeeping. If there's a common, for example, if there is just...
What is that, though? We know, what we can't understand is what is more than mere bookkeeping.
You know, Your Honor, I explained some examples. Again, it's hard to give just a concrete line because of the variety of different types of grantees that participate. But this is something that HHS...
Can they pay for, out of Title X funds, can they pay for travel to get an abortion? Like, can they refer and pay for travel?
No, Your Honor. I mean, to be clear also about the referral requirement, they can't arrange travel. HHS said that in its 2020 final rule.
So if a clinic pays for out of Title X funds for travel, that's improper?
Travel to receive an abortion?
Yes.
Your Honor, they can't arrange travel. That's in the 2021 final rule. HHS said that. And again, to be clear about what the referral requirement is, it's really the logical outcome of the non-directive counseling requirement to which plaintiffs don't object. Under the final rule, if a pregnant patient asks to receive options, the Title X grantee gives the patient, the pregnant woman, information on prenatal care, adoption services, and pregnancy termination. And as a result of that counseling, if the woman says, you know, thank you for telling me my options, I've chosen option X, under the rule, you provide neutral, factual information.
Yeah, but
can you tell me what an abortion element is? Because I know the state points to language, you say look at all the language, but I want to understand, what's an abortion element?
I think that's referring to abortion-related services. I mean, plaintiffs are taking...
I'm sorry to be negligent, but what's abortion-related services?
I think it would be, you know, the provision of abortion, but also services directly related to that. I mean, it's...
So could they pay for the equipment used to give an abortion?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so.
So what is related to abortion? What are abortion-related services that they can pay for out of Title X funds?
Well, I don't think, Your Honor, that they can pay for abortion-related services.
Well, it says, let me read you the language and we can talk about it. What must be looked at is whether the abortion element in a program of family planning services is so large and so intimately related to all aspects of the program as to make it difficult or impossible to separate the eligible and non-eligible items of cost. So what does it mean, impossible to separate?
That's the part in that quote that you just read. That's from the 2000 Federal Register notice. It says abortion element in a family planning program. That is not a Title X family planning program. That section of the 2000 Register notice is referring to a situation in which an abortion provider would not be eligible for Title X funds because their abortion-related activities encompass so much of their activities that they can't have a separate Title X project.
Yeah, but I think what we're struggling with is that seems to be your definition of separate. So you say a grant applicant, oh, wait a minute. Well, no, here it is. The grantee must ensure that the Title X supported project is separate and distinguishable from the other activities. What must be looked at, so in other words, how we tell whether it's separate and distinguishable is whether when you put them all together, whether the abortion element in a program of family planning services is too big. If you've got too much abortion, you put them together, the program's too big so that you can't, it's difficult or impossible to separate eligible and non-eligible items of cost. So what separate means is I can't do my cost accounting. That's your definition of separate, but then you say it also has to be more than that. But it doesn't have to be physical separation. So I'm trying to figure out what is the separation? What do you want?
Again, Your Honor, I mean, what that 2000 Register, Federal Register notice is talking about is when, you know, again, there it wouldn't be possible to maintain sufficient.
And that's the only time you can fail.
Well, Your Honor, if, again, it's a fact-specific inquiry depending on many of the circumstances involving in that particular healthcare entity, the type of building that they have, the type of services that they have. And it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. And HHS, because this has been the rule that's been in place for, again, nearly the entirety of the history of the program, HHS has worked out these differences with individual grantees through guidance, again, over the course for several years. And HHS talks about that process in the 2000 Federal Register notice. And, you know, plaintiff separation argument is that essentially no degree of separation would be enough because they argue that any amount of funds that HHS is providing to an abortion provider frees up that abortion provider's money to pay for other services.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I understand that as long as grantees can be abortion providers, there will be some economies of scale. I take that point. But what I don't understand is what your rule actually requires that is more than bookkeeping, because every example you give says it can be all together as long as you keep the books separate. And then you say, but it has to be separate, and our definition of separate is you can keep the books separate.
Your Honor, again, the final rule refers to, for example, administrative counseling admission protocols. There's
what would that look like? Like, maybe that helps me. Like, what do you mean by protocols?
Again, Your Honor, if, for example, a grantee is only making abortion-related services and appointments on one day of the week, and then another day of the week they have separate Title X services, and then therefore in their counseling service protocols, admission protocols, there is a separation, even if it's not strict physical separation. And at the end of the day, again, this is a rule to ensure that Title X funds are not being used to pay for abortions.
If I don't have them on separate days of the week, is a provider permitted to do them on the same days of the week?
Again, if there's a large hospital, for example, and there were separate wings, there would be not necessarily, you know.
But then it must be some kind of physical separation. So you're saying there must be some kind of time-space separation is required.
You know, again, the final rule is clear that there must be more than a mere technical bookkeeping. You couldn't have abortion-related services and Title X services simultaneously in the same appointment, for example. That's not a separation.
Can they refer you down the hall for 2 minutes later? So you come in, 11:30 to 11:58, you discuss it. They say, I want an abortion. At 12 o'clock, you can walk down the hall and get one.
You know, that might not be enough separation. It's hard to, again, say, given all the circumstances and because of the variety of grantees, you know, I don't know if I can go hypothetical by hypothetical, but certainly HHS is requiring a separation.
So you can't answer that question yes or no. The answer may be yes, it may be no.
My instinct, Your Honor, is that that wouldn't be sufficient because it seems like a simultaneous same appointment situation. And again, this is...
What if the appointment ends at 12 and they refer you, they say, go get lunch and then we'll give you, you can get an abortion.
And Your Honor, HHS is monitoring this to ensure grantee compliance, to ensure that there is a separation. This is something that HHS, you know, has taken seriously for the better part of 40 years as it's administered this program. And again, HHS conducted a fresh review of the record from independent agencies and found no instance of...
Can I go back to my travel hypo? If the Secretary were to allocate funds under Title X for travel, you agree that would be a violation?
The rule is clear, Your Honor, that you cannot arrange transportation for a woman to obtain an abortion.
Or pay for it.
Right, Your Honor, that's...
And so you agree if the Secretary said that's why they're allocating the funds, for example, to Planned Parenthood, that would be a violation.
Within this program, Your Honor, HHS itself in its rule has said that you can't arrange transportation, which would include pay for transportation. Again, I can't speak outside of this rule or this program, but that's the line that HHS has drawn, and that's clearly within... that's clearly compliant with Section 1008. I see that I'm almost out of time. I'm happy to answer any other questions if the court has them. We ask that you affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you.
Judge Moore, I know I've eaten into my rebuttal time, so I'll try to keep it very...
No, you're fine.
Very brief. I have 2 points. The first is what I think our discussion here today has shown is that they do not have any line at all. They say to look to protocols, they say to look to policies, but they can't tell you what those policies must show. What it amounts to is an I know it when I see it test. And with all due respect to the great Ohioan for whom this courthouse is named, that's not a limit at all. And Judge Tappar, this is my second point. You asked about have there ever been violations. I would refer you to, this is 65 Federal Register 41,276, 65 FedReg 41,276. That's the 2000 rule that they're readopting. There they note that prior to Rust, the pre-1989 rule, there actually was a physical separation limit. But HHS said, yeah, no one really knew what it meant, so we didn't enforce it anyway, so we'll just get rid of it. So their solution to an inadequate guard was not to beef up the guard, it was to eliminate it entirely. And then I guess I said 2 points, but I'll add one third one. Just look at the announcement that was issued with the most recent round of grants. There is no doubt that the whole point of this was to bring abortion providers back into the Title X program and indeed to allow the number one provider of abortions in the country to participate.
Can I ask you about that? So we can consider under Trump and some of the other, Trump v. Hawaii and some of the other cases, what the official says about funding, right?
That is what I understand those cases to say, yes.
So let me read you the statement by Secretary Becerra and ask you what we should make of this. HHS will continue to work to make more funding available under the Title X program to help clinics with capacity limitations and support, and this is the point I was focusing on with your friend, support patient travel from states where abortion is banned.
I think, again, going back to the causation point, what that shows further is the court should not exhibit a naivete from which ordinary citizens are free. If there are no further questions.
But can we pay, we can pay attention to that.
That is how I read, and I would have said no in 2015, but I think today you can, yes. If there are no further questions, we ask that you reverse. Thank you.
Thank you. The case will be submitted.